and welcome to episode number 7 of Robot Radio. This is Greg Stanwood along with Andrew Martin. I think I'm going to start saying the date at the beginning of each one. This is going to be March 22nd, 2010. And so we
when they listen to it. Oh, I was about to say, it's the 20th, man. What are you talking about?
No, it's the 22nd.
Oh, that's
Shut
right.
Up.
We're recording live again. Yeah.
Anyway, so we're now about 3/4 of the way, maybe a little less, through spring training. We've got about we've basically got 2 weeks left. So I guess it's more like 2/3, maybe. So I guess point being, there's still some time left for a bunch of important things to get resolved, and it seems like more and more are starting to show up. Especially now that we got the bad news this week that Houston Street will be opening the season on the disabled list.
The news is better than it could have been. I mean, at least the MRI showed no damage, and I know that that doesn't necessarily mean anything at this point, but it's a mild positive at least.
I suppose. It certainly is a positive in the sense that we know that there's not a structural problem to worry about, you know, something like Corpus had last year or something. But I think a couple people on the comment section were also pointing out it also doesn't really give any insight into what's wrong. And if it becomes like a walking problem, something that keeps flaring up regularly, it could be even harder to fix.
Yeah, that when you hear a guy breaks his leg, that sucks. But, you know, he's going to be out for a month or two, give or take, you know, whatever. If a guy has a big injury, they pretty much know how to deal with big injuries. But it's the pulls, the strains, the stuff like that that could just linger on forever. That's just the problem in all sports.
Yeah, and with this, just quote-unquote inflammation, like, I mean, there's ways to deal with that, but what happens if it doesn't go away?
Now, I'm just hoping they're not giving us a runaround and calling inflammation when he's really, you know, his arm was severed or something like that.
Well, I don't think they do that, and I mean, I especially don't think they would be parading Street out there talking about it. They've been interviewing him, and he says, you know, basically the same thing. So, and I mean, especially since he was doing so well for a while, that's what's so disappointing about it, and also kind of what's scary about it, is that he seemed fine for, like, you know, 5 days, and he was throwing just fine, and then all of a sudden, oop, it's sore again. You know, that obviously kind of makes me nervous that, like, oh, well, Street's better now, he's thrown a week in the minors, and everything's fine, and then his first appearance back off the DL, his arm falls off.
Yeah, it's just a tough kind of thing to look at, because I don't want to say, well, I think he's going to be fine. I think my gut feeling is going to be fine, but then again, my gut feeling doesn't know anything. That's why I'm not a doctor. Something just tells me it's going to be all right. And what at least makes me kind of happy about it is that Street's been pretty upfront about it, saying, like, I thought it was okay, but apparently it's not. And he seems like a real honest, upfront, not going to spin you around in circles kind of guy, at least as far as what he can say, says. I mean, look at how he owned up at the end of the postseason, you know. He makes no bones about it. He knows what's going on, and he's not going to try to hide from the problems. He's going to face them.
We have Rafael Betancourt, who seems to be improving. He threw against some minor leaguers today. He threw 29 pitches, I believe, and everything went well, and he said that he believes he's on track to open the season regularly. He's going to get 4 to 5 Cactus League starts, one next week, one next weekend, and then the following week they're going to give him a go in back-to-back games to see if he can do it.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, assuming all that goes well and there's no crazy relapses like with Street, then at the very least I'm pleased we're going to have one of them.
With Betancourt's case, it seemed a lot like it was just that off-season sickness that just sapped his strength, sapped his conditioning. So that his shoulder sort of really was just, I'm not in baseball shape yet because I was sick all off-season, and my shoulder's like, whoa, what are you doing? You were just hanging out. Why are we working again?
Basically, I want to take this time now to, like, break down exactly where we stand in regards to what this changes about who projects to make the team and who may project to make the team, I guess is the better way to put it. As it stands right now, I think with all this craziness that's been going on, and I mean, it's not just limited to Street and Betancourt. Obviously, Belial had some problems. He seems to be back. Flores got hit in the arm. He seems like he's going to be okay. And then some of our backup people have been having problems with, like, Jimmy Gobble and such. So we've hit some bad luck in that area, so we have some pretty significant constraints, which is why at this point, I mean, last week we were talking about how, you know, maybe if Corpus doesn't show anything, we could probably start him at AAA if we had to. And I brought up that, you know, maybe we shouldn't say that Matt Daly should outright make the team. I think at this point, let's forget about all that and just say they're both making the team.
We just got to look at the guys who are going to be healthiest and going to be able to do the job the best. And really, I mean, I don't think I would be against a Manny Corpus trip to AAA. I mean,
even now?
I guess I'm thinking the more ideal situation where we did it, where it wasn't an issue of Corpus makes the team because Corpus has to make the team because we don't have an option, but more along the lines of, let's fix Manny Corpus and say, hey, dude, go to AAA, work with the pitching people down there, because there's going to be no pressure, even who cares if the Sky Sox lose another game. It's not a big deal as far as the Major League club goes. See if you can figure out what you've been doing wrong, where if you screw it up again, well, you're learning how to do it right again, you're not hurting the team, and then you pop back up and say, hey, I'm fixed now, because these things happen.
That was my logic last week, and I guess the point I'm trying to make is that at this point, I don't think I can say that I'm taking that position anymore, because I'm getting nervous about the lack of freedom we're going to have, in the sense that, you know, we have one player out, we have one player who could be out if something goes in the wrong direction. We have already two or three players that we don't trust very much, and we have limited options elsewhere. So I guess at this point I'm saying I don't think, and again this is totally just my opinion, I don't think we have a choice anymore. I think I have to put him on that team. And the same goes with Matt Daly. And of course, Daly's been doing okay. I really have been the only one that's been really concerned about him. So
I'm concerned too. I mean, when spring ERAs are the kind of thing that I don't like to look at. I like to look more at, you know, I don't like to look at ERAs that much in general. Just, I mean, it's a good barometer, I suppose, but spring ERA can mean any number of things, where I'm looking more to see how many guys do they walk, how many guys do they strike out, where was the ball located, things like that. And really, I'm at the point now where outside of our premium guys we know pretty much have to make the club or our out-of-option guys, I'm almost at the point we take whatever spots we have left, lump the rest, the extras in, and say, okay, who earned a major league spot right now?
So assuming at this point that it's only Street who's going to be out, and assuming that Corpus and Daly are no longer question marks and they're going to be in there, you still have one open spot left. And at this point, I can't call specifically who it's going to be, but there's just so many different issues going on here that I think besides just spring training performances, whoever gets that final spot, there's a whole lot of considerations going into it. The first of which, I think, is who's going to take over for closer. At this point, we know it's not going to be Betancourt. Tracy wants to keep him in the eighth inning, and even if he didn't, he probably wouldn't be healthy enough anyway, or they wouldn't have enough confidence in him. So what that means is that, again, according to the official determinations from the manager and from everybody else, it's between Morales, Corpus, and Belial.
If Matt Belial's closing, we're in a sore spot, aren't we?
Well, I've been saying that I would prefer Morales, probably, even though he's had the worst spring. I think he's done the job more successfully more recently than either of the other two, and I probably have more confidence in his stuff than the other two as well.
Well, just talking to Rank, he's saying that Morales is really starting to find a groove, and even if it doesn't show up in the forms of a spring training ERA, well, I mean, I think I've made my stance at the spring training ERA somewhat clear by now. And, I mean, I pulled up briefly in the comment sections Morales' ninth inning splits, and he's pretty good in the ninth innings so far. I mean, sample size issues and all that, but he held opponents to a sub-600 OPS, and he had a 2-plus strikeout-to-walk ratio. I mean, again, small sample sizes, but it shows that at least he's trying to bring his best stuff in the ninth, and it looks like he's, you know, doing pretty well at it. And we know when it comes to closing with a guy that isn't your closer, it's a very much a what have you done for me lately situation.
Actually, I got into this discussion in the comment section yesterday evening time, and I was debating with somebody, I can't remember who it was, I'm sorry, off the top of my head, but about Belial and Morales, and somebody was making the case for Belial because he had the 1 month of successful pitching at the end. And Also, I mean, devil's advocate support of Belisle, he's had the best spring of the three of them, not counting the injury. He's pitched four or five innings now, completely clean, basically.
Mm-hmm. And then the same thing to think about, too, is if we're just going to go off 1 month of Belisle, we don't have that much more to go off of for Morales, either.
True. I'm still leaning toward Morales, though. I would probably feel most comfortable with him in there. And that's not to say, like, on the comfortable scale, it would be all that high. But I think it would be higher than the other two.
I think they wanted Morales to finally show that he can step up and do something. I mean, he stepped up in 2007, obviously, in that starting role. And we just want to say, hey, okay, what are you going to step up to do now? Because we need you to produce in some way, shape, or form.
Well, yeah, we were talking about this the other day, how I think you were saying that you wanted the organization to point him in a direction and say, go there. And now's that opportunity. They can point to the closer role and say, we want you here until Houston Street's ready to go. Can you do it? And his first outing since this was a possibility was okay. We're probably going to see him 3, 4, maybe even 5 more times before spring training is done. So anyway, what all that's leading up to is I think at this point, beyond spring training statistics and performance, the other thing that's going to have a huge role in determining who gets the seventh bullpen spot is who gets selected to be closer. Because if you put Belisle there, it's different than putting, say, Morales there, because you're losing something different in the actual bullpen, like the spot they're vacating to move to closer. Tracy has said that he wants another lefty if Morales gets the job, or at least he's thinking about it, which means there would be three lefties. He feels uncomfortable with the fact that Flores would be the only lefty that's basically a middle reliever and is not on the hook at the end of the game. So the problem with that is, who's it going to be? Jimmy Gobble's hurt. Matt Reynolds is young and not necessarily the guy you would prefer. People have thrown around, of course, and there's been some discussion between the two sides here, is that they might be thinking about offering something to Joe Bimel to bring him back.
I've also seen it's linked to Juan Cruz of the Royals.
Is Juan Cruz a lefty?
Oh, no, lefty. No, my mistake there. He's not a lefty.
Just asking your opinion, do you prefer Bimel over a young lefty in the system like Matt Reynolds?
Well, it really depends on if this is going to hinder us later in the season. I mean, what Bimel still wants, you know, $2 million major league contract, etc. And that's a bit disconcerting because I don't think we have much budget room left.
We don't have a lot of room left, but basically the idea that I'd come up with was, I agree that we really shouldn't just offer him whatever we want. whatever he wants. But what we could do is just offer him a smidgen more than what the Mets are offering.
And yeah, they're offering about $500,000, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, so offer him $1 million and say, look, we're willing to pay you more money than anybody else is. We're totally willing to give you a spot on our team. We have the opening. We liked you while you were here. You liked us. You know, here's more money than anyone else is willing to give you. It's not what you want, but it's more than we think you're going to get. How about it?
And he's admitted he liked it here in Colorado. He really did enjoy being part of this club.
Yeah, he said great things, and he's still saying. People have just recently asked him, you know, what do you think about returning? He's like, oh, it'd be great. I think it would be fine. You know, I think really the only object here is not the team, but the money. And I assume that right now, as far as I know, as far as has been reported, the only major league contract he's been offered is with New York.
Yeah, I've heard inklings of other teams being interested in him, but if it clearly hasn't been more than what the Mets have offered, if he hasn't signed with anyone yet.
Right. So offering more than that is at least going to get his attention, and it's at least possible that maybe he'll say, well, you know, no one else has given me anything. I might as well settle for this.
And $600,000-$700,000. I mean, it's, you know, it seems funny to say that's not that much money considering how deep into student loan debt I am, but it's not the kind of, you know, contract that would break the bank for a club. And if we can't afford something that small there, then we really are in trouble. But I guess the concern is that if we try, I think they're going to go internal, because really, We got to look a little bit further down the road. I mean, I don't mean seasons down, but just a couple months away, because once Street is healthy again, and we're assuming Street's going to be healthy again, and Taylor Buchholz comes back looking great, and, you know, maybe Casey Weathers makes a big jump, maybe Rex Brothers forces our hand, whatever, and we suddenly have money tied up in guys, not just, oh, you're making the league men, we took a flyer on you, whatever, you're cut now. I mean, because Bimal, I mean, he's not phenomenal, but he's still somewhat of a, you know, major league caliber pitcher. What do we do when we come to June, July, and we, you know, I mean, you can never have too much pitching, obviously, but who gets stuck down in AAA, who gets cut, who gets whatever, and I think they're hesitant on offering major league money to anyone for that reason.
The only concern, and I mean, the reason I'm just so in support of signing Bimal, if Morales becomes the closer, is, first of all, we've already established, or Jim Tracy has already established, he does not intend to make Greg Smith a reliever, so he is crossed off. De La Rosa, Flores, Francis, Morales, the other lefties at the major league level right now, they're all already on the team in other places. So basically, we're left looking inside, interior, for options for left-handed pitchers. And as I already explained, Jimmy Gobble's out. Rank told me he thinks he's going to start on the DL. There's Matt Reynolds. And beyond that, you know, looking down like the minor league ranks, there's not a lot I see that is really reliably close to making the team. We can look at the minor leaguers we've signed, you know, just out of the blue.
Mm-hmm.
People like Damian Moss, who pitched an inning today and was awful. In fact, the radio announcers were saying that they thought the only reason Damian Moss was given an inning today was because they wanted to give him a look to see if he could actually make the team if Morales went to the closer role, and he didn't really step up and do that.
No.
And so, really, inside, I think our only real option is Matt Reynolds. Unless you can think of somebody else.
Not as far as lefties go. I mean, I feel like we're hamstringing ourselves by saying, oh, we need another lefty.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, situationally,
I'm just going off of what Tracy himself said he would like. I don't know that they're going to go this way. They might say, well, you know, just for the sake of having a lefty, putting Reynolds on the team is stupid. Let's go with somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
But he said that it was a concern at the very least. So,
well, having lefties is one thing, but I mean, this is just, it sounds like a Jim Tracy kind of thing to say, and I don't mean to, you know, spit that with as much hatred as it might come off with, but, you know, oh good, now we can play more, you need a lefty just so you can play your matchups? Why are we sacrificing handedness? I mean, we're sacrificing major league out-getting ability for handedness? I mean, if Justin Spires having a spring and a half, give him the spot. I would like to have matchups that are favorable for the team, but we want the guys who are going to be able to get out, and that's more what I'm concerned about. And don't get me wrong, if we re-sign Bimal to come and take that extra spot, I'm not going to throw a fit. I am not against Joe Bimal coming back. It's more just the idea that we're saying, oh no, we have to have a left-hander. And I'm saying, oh no, we have to have the best pitchers available. The best guys should be the ones that are playing.
So forgetting the left-handed discussion now and moving on to, I mean, not just if Corpus or Belial takes the spot, but just looking at some of the other options we do have. On roster, it would basically require us putting a minor leaguer like Shane Lindsay up there or taking one of our young starters like Chassin or DeDuno or somebody and giving them a 2 or 3 weeks of bullpen work, which I can't say I'm really a fan of. And then, of course, the other option is adding an NRI, and there's really three that are left that can take that spot, being Spire, Rincon, and Redding. My choice of those three is obviously Spire. If Belial were somehow to wind up in the closer's role, which I really don't think is going to happen, but if let's say Morales and Corpus give up 28 earned runs in their next throughout the rest of the spring and Belial doesn't give up any, then we might, I suppose, that might happen, and that means we would lose our long reliever, which probably makes Redding the favorite to take over that spot, unless, like, they keep Morales as a long reliever or something.
Now, this all makes sense. I mean, if you're losing your Spire's more of a middle type, Redding's going to be more of a long reliever type, and I mean, that makes perfect sense, that we want to make sure we at least have some semblance of order in the bullpen as far as, you know, even loosely defined roles go.
So Spire is a good option. Rincon is a scary option for most robots, but I wouldn't be totally opposed to it, although I'd prefer Spire. And Redding is Redding. We're going to get what we're going to get, but as a long reliever, as we've already had the discussion a couple episodes ago, you can't really do too bad in choosing your long reliever, as long as they can throw the baseball in some, you know, reasonable direction towards the home plate, then you don't need to worry too much about them, because they're going to be pitching in the blowout games.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they usually their games, as long as they don't give up four runs, they're in good shape.
So to sum up, we've got presumably six people still left, unless there's some disturbing changes with injuries. And our options for the final spot are dependent on the closer, who takes that spot, as well as, I guess, the remaining spring performances. And the four people who, or the, I guess the five people who are most likely to wind up in that spot in one way or another are Spire, Redding, or Rincon off the NRI list, Reynolds from the minors, or Joe Bimel from free agency. So the other major spring training performance thing that I want to talk about is defense. And it's been a concern. Just a couple stats that I want to throw out at you. The Rockies have 27 errors as of today, which is five more than any other team in spring training. They also have the lowest fielding percentage at .964. And this is now out of, let's see, 20 games that we've played. 27 errors in 20 games.
That's not good.
No, that's not good for even half of these games being played by minor leaguers. That's not good.
No.
There's only three teams, I believe, that have more than 20 errors, and we're already almost at 30. It's been pretty bad, especially for Ian Stewart, who has always had some defensive problems. He showed some great defensive characteristics last season, and I can't remember if it was you on the podcast that I was talking about this with, or somebody in the comment section was basically saying that he's shown great movement and defensive range capabilities, but his problem is his hands.
Well, that's what it might have been me that we talked about that with. That's one of the when you looked at Stewart and our former third baseman Garrett Atkins had good hands, but he just had no range. Stewart has very good range, but he has poor hands. So it kind of depends on what the play is, because, you know, bad range can lead to a single rolling into the outfield, whereas bad hands can lead to a ball going into the dugout. So it kind of depends on, you know, what the situation is. I personally take range over everything. He just needs to. I've heard complaints from a couple people who, you know, look at more of the scouting side of things, and they deem Stewart to, you know, make a lot of dumb mistakes, and I'm not exactly opposing that. He does make some dumb mistakes, but he's also a young ball player, and he's gonna get. Well, that's just kind of the thing. Young players will always get better. I think that he has the potential to get better, especially with a team that emphasizes fielding so strongly. There's no way that this is just gonna go unchecked. There just isn't. Well, here's another thing. We know Barmas is a good fielder. We also know that he has his hiccups where he'll make a really stupid turn on a double play or something like that. But we know he is a good fielder. Similarly, it's kind of an abstract correlation here, but Todd Helton's batting like crap so far. But then again, we know that Todd Helton's a .330 hitter, and et cetera, et cetera. It's spring. I mean, not just to, you know, throw in, it's spring training, don't worry about it, but these kind of seem like the kind of wrinkles that'll get ironed out as the season goes on. Because there's no way that a guy like Tulowitzki is going to let his infield make stupid decisions all the time. That's one thing that Barmas said about Tulowitzki during the interview, is that Tulowitzki's a real field leader, and he makes better around him about always being in position, always knowing how the plays go. I get the impression that maybe if he's not, you know, intentionally working with Stewart, because that might be a bit awkward. You see what I'm getting at, but there's no way that this is going to go unchecked. There's no way that the flaws in Stewart's game are just going to go unchecked.
You also mentioned that the organization as a whole is very big on fielding, and I believe that's absolutely the case, and that's part of the reason why these defensive issues in the spring have stood out so much. It's not just because we've been so poor in comparison to other teams. It's that we're used to having, you know, team after team come in every year and be defensively, you know, miraculous. We had the best defensive team in baseball history according to some statistics, in 2007, I believe.
Yeah, yeah. We beat the Red Sox for all-time fielding percentage for a team.
So we're used to having these sorts of things just almost be second nature. People still marvel at, like, Tulo's crazy flying throws or Todd Helton's amazing, you know, grabbing balls out of the dirt. Yet at the same time, it's almost become second nature. We almost expect this level of defensive capability from everybody involved. And usually, up until now, it's been fantastic, and it's not been a problem. And at this point, I'm not saying it's going to be a problem, but it's showing itself as a potential problem.
Again, this seems like the kind of thing that'll iron itself out. I mean, it is frustrating. Now, you're absolutely right that our expectations are so high that anything less than excellent is going to be, you know, string the bum up. I mean, just, like, look at Tulowitzki's 2008 where he started. I remember he made, like, two errors on opening day. And we're all saying, what's going on with our, you know, proven stud of an awesome shortstop here? And, well, he ended up tearing his quad, but that was a bad year. But you see the point there. I mean, we're expecting, after someone marvels us with something, we expect to just be marveled with everything they do. And sometimes it's fair to have that expectation for elite-level players like Todd Helton. But for guys who are 24, like Ian Stewart, he made that one ridiculous throw while, you know, sitting on his butt and throwing the guy out of first. We're expecting that out of him all the time now. And while I don't think it's out of the line of reason to expect him not to make four errors in, what, like six games or something like that, then we should make sure to temper our expectations a bit, especially with the younger guys that they're still growing. They're still trying to figure a lot of stuff out. And I'm not trying to necessarily make excuses for them, but more just offer explanations that, you know, maybe Stewart is just so wound up about his strikeout totals and stuff like that. Maybe his head's not entirely in the game fielding, which is not a good thing, but it seems like the kind of thing that will come around.
Well, I think that discusses everything that I wanted to talk about, but you mentioned to me that you're interested in discussing the team's sacrifice bunts.
Oh, geez, sacrifice bunts.
So I'm going to throw out a statistic for you here. It's been updated. In spring training, this is both leagues, Cactus League and Grapefruit League. In spring training 2010, on today, March 20th, the Florida Marlins are number two in sacrifice bunts with 5 sacrifice bunts. Number one is the Colorado Rockies with 11.
Jeez. How many of those are non-pitchers, though?
Four of them are non-pitchers.
4 out of 11 are non-pitchers. So I can see the 7 because I think our pitchers have been taking a lot of at-bats during the spring that I've noticed.
3 of them by themselves are by Jason Hammel. He's the only player in the entire league to have more than one.
That's impressive. I remember 2005 or 2006, Josh Fogg just had a million sacrifice bunts. It was 2005 because Corey Sullivan and Josh Fogg were like the two best sack bunters in baseball or something like that. What I'm thinking here is I don't mind sacrifice bunts provided they're properly used. And when I say properly used, I mean the pitcher bunting, because you want a sacrifice bunt when there's a better chance of the pitcher just making a terrible out or a totally not productive out or whatever by batting rather than just giving up the out and getting the guy to second or third or whatever. But with position players, I mean, unless we are talking about ninth inning, tie game, walk-off situation, playing for one run, where playing for one run is more important than playing for two, three, whatever, however many runs you'd want in the second, third, fourth, whatever inning, I don't want to see position players bunting. I just don't. I mean, I know that, I mean, if it's a, sometimes it is good. A smart heads-up play, sometimes a bunt will look good, but not a sacrifice bunt. A sacrifice bunt, I mean, historically, I can't remember the manager's name, but he would stand on the top of the dugout stairs and yell, "They're giving us an out! Go ahead and pitch it to him! Don't pitch around his bunt!" It seems like a poor way to use an out when you have guys who are better at not making outs. It just seems like a waste of a situation to me. And when you have a guy who's fast enough to, who can split a gap and fast enough to take two, why are we bunting with him? This kind of goes onto my terror that Dexter Fowler could be a 300 hitter who has 45, 50 doubles a season, that we're trying to turn him into Dave Roberts or Juan Pierre. I don't want to see that.
We were joking about this in the comments section. I don't know if you saw it. It was a couple days ago about how Dexter Fowler will be the team's personal sack bunter in the two-hole. This is why I don't want him in the two-hole. I still, everybody says, Cargo number one is fine, Dexter number two is fine. I still want to switch them. I agree. Dexter leading off.
I completely agree. Dexter found an on-base machine, and he's fast enough to steal bases. I'm not saying Gonzalez can't, but Dex is one of those guys who's getting on base and stealing him is going to be one of his primary threats.
And we just know that if Gonzalez hits a single or walks or something, Fowler is going to be told to bunt, whereas Gonzalez in that case probably wouldn't.
Yeah, precisely. I mean, you look at their on-base percentages. I mean, I know that Gonzalez ended up, I think he ended up slightly better than Fowler just because of the fact that he had, you know, had a better batting average than Fowler. But Fowler's on, he's an on-base machine. The team knows this. Everyone knows this. I mean, Tracy's acknowledged it. Dexter Fowler is an on-base machine. And if we can get him on base in the number one spot, then hey, look at slugging percentage. That's what you want to get those guys from first base all the way to home plate is slugging percentage. And I don't want to see Fowler wasted like that. We're trying to build a lineup based on, you know, the success we had in, you know, August and September. And that's not necessarily, I mean, it's not a bad way to do it, but I mean, you can't just go and say, hey, let's ride the glory and hope that magic continues to work. I mean, it just doesn't make much sense. If that magic still worked, we'd still have Mark Redman. My concern is, like I mentioned already, that we're trying to turn Fowler into Juan Pierre. If you want to turn Eric Young Jr. into Juan Pierre, go for it. The guy has not shown himself to be much more than a singles hitter, which is fine for what his job is going to be. He's going to be a leadoff type hitter, or, you know, if you want to go crazy Tony La Russa style, which I like, put him as a number nine hitter to kind of have the same effect. Point is that Eric Young, if you want to make him into a weird, crazy bunt machine, go for it, because that's what his major strength is speed and a good batter's eye. But with Fowler, with gap-splitting ability, I mean, well, that's... So now I've kind of talked myself into a complete circle here, because if Fowler has that doubles ability, why not put him behind Carlos Gonzalez? But if we're just going to use him to sacrifice Carlos over, then what's the point of having that gap-splitting ability? Clint Hurdle loved the sacrifice bunt. Loved it. Loved it. And I thought we got away from that. Apparently not.
Okay, going into the schedule for next week, Monday the 22nd, we're at Cincinnati, 205. Tuesday the 23rd, San Diego, 210. Wednesday the 24th, we have a day off. It's the only day off of the spring. Thursday the 25th, Cincinnati, 210. Friday at Cleveland, 205. Saturday the 27th, at the White Sox, 210. No, at home against the White Sox, 210. And Sunday the 28th at Oakland, 205. Well, I think that about wraps it up. On behalf of myself and Andrew, take care.